This is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. Starting Thursday night, Americans will get a first-hand accounting of how the U.S. Capitol attack January 6th of last year unfolded. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The House panel investigating last year's Capitol riot is ready to go public with its findings, starting with a primetime hearing tonight. Pete Aguilar says the committee's interviewed more than 1,000 people, reviewed more than 140,000 documents.
We're ready to tell the story.
Fellow member Elaine Luria says it's a chilling story about a conspiracy to corrupt the entire government.
The hair on the back of your neck should stand up.
The panel's promising new and explosive information over a series of hearings, though it's unclear what that will entail. Republicans like Elise Stefanik are dismissing the entire probe as illegitimate.
It is a smear campaign
against Donald Trump and his backers. House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy calls it a diversion.
I wish they would really have a primetime hearing on is inflation.
Most major broadcast networks and cable news channels say they will carry the hearing live. Fox News Channel will not. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Lawmakers say they hope to show the American public how close democracy came to the brink of disaster. The U.S. House has passed a wide-ranging gun control bill in response to recent mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas. This is how it sounded.
On this vote, the yeas are 223, the nays are 204. The bill is passed. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
The bill would raise the age limit for purchasing a semi-automatic rifle and prohibit the sale of ammunition magazines of more than 15 rounds. This is VOA News. Ukrainian fighters were holding out in the eastern city of Severodonetsk Thursday despite relentless Russian shelling, the regional governor said, as Moscow presses an assault that both sides believe could help shape the war's course. Russia has concentrated its troops and firepower on the small industrial city to secure the surrounding province on behalf of Moscow-backed separatists. Ukraine's forces pulled back to the city's outskirts Wednesday, but have vowed to fight there for as long as possible. Excuse me. A man accused of driving into a school group in Berlin, killing a teacher and injuring several others, has a history of mental illness. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The man is suspected of murder and 31 counts of attempted murder. Prosecutor Sebastian Butchner said the man would most likely be sent to a psychiatric hospital. When searching his apartment, investigators found medicine that would suggest the suspect was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. Police identified the suspect as a 29-year-old German-Armenian who lives in Berlin. They said he was driving his sister's car and that a passerby detained him after he crashed to a halt in a shop window. I'm Karen Chamas.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was on a surprise visit to the United Arab Emirates Thursday, a snap trip that came as efforts to salvage a deal over Iran's nuclear program were stalled amid a deepening standoff with Tehran. The visit was Bennett's second public trip to Abu Dhabi since Israel and the UAE agreed to normalize ties in 2020 after years of quiet cooperation. U.S. President Joe Biden told attendees at the Summit of the Americas that democracy is under assault. Mr. Biden opened the summit in Los Angeles with a speech Wednesday evening.
As we meet again today, in a moment when democracy is under assault around the world, let us unite again and renew our conviction that democracy is not only the defining feature of American histories, but the essential ingredient to America's future.
Six-time golf major winner Phil Mickelson and Ian Poulter were among six players who've had their membership of the PGA Tour suspended Thursday as they prepare to play in the opening event of the Breakaway Leave Golf Tour. It is the first of an eight-event, $255 million series, which is backed by Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund. Having signed a contract reportedly worth over $125 million, Tuesday the PGA Tour was rocked by the news that former world number one Dustin Johnson had resigned his membership in favor of the Leave Golf Series. However, Mickelson said he had no intention of following suit and fully intended to play in the U.S. Open, which starts June 16th. And recapping our top story, starting Thursday tonight, Americans will get a first-hand account of how the U.S. Capitol attack January 6th unfolded.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud was inaugurated as the 10th president of Somalia today. And Belgian King Philip continues his visit to Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll have these stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. In South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa spoke to Parliament about his budget proposal. It was his first major speech before Parliament since allegations arose that he covered up the theft of millions of dollars in cash from his home. Some members of the opposition, led by the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, or EFF, are calling for Ramaphosa to step down. Reporter Tuso Kumalo in Johannesburg gives VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson a rundown on the speech.
The main point of his speech was to explain how the presidency is going to be using its budget that it has been allocated. And mainly, he spoke about things that he had done and saying the government is doing all its best to make sure that crime goes down by making sure more police are trained and also improving social services. And also talking strongly about how the government, his administration, is dealing with corruption, trying by all means to make sure that the state funds that have been put out there, they are used effectively. And also, of course, we know that it happened at a time when the South African economy is also not performing well because of the load shedding, which means the electricity having to be cut because the generators are not working well, saying the government is doing its best to try and make sure that the generation plants are working effectively, and also saying he has opened up to independent power producers so that there is a mix. There are people who depend on natural energy in addition to what Eskom is offering. So giving a number of things that the government has done and what the government is going to do to try and make sure that jobs are created and that poverty is reduced.
The president is facing some pressure over allegations that a theft of millions of dollars, $4 million or more U.S. dollars, were stolen from his farm, but that the crime was somewhat covered up. What did he say about that? Anything at all?
Nothing at all. President Ramaphosa had hardly spoken for a minute when, of course, the Economic Freedom Fighters members started interjecting him, raising that point to say they cannot be allowed, they cannot be addressed by President Ramaphosa, some of them calling him a criminal, some of them calling him a money launderer. For a good hour, the sessions could not proceed in Parliament because there was a noise from the members of the Economic Freedom Fighters saying Ramaphosa should be ejected out of Parliament, should not be allowed to address an Augusta House. So there was that noise which made Ramaphosa not to be able to address for almost an hour until the entire members of the Economic Freedom Fighters were ejected out of Parliament. This is when he started talking. So the issue still being topical here in South Africa. A lot of people saying the explanation that has been given by Ramaphosa is not satisfactory because he doesn't say what was that man doing there and why was it not banked. How can they prove that it came from clean hands and clean deals, like he alleges that it came from a game, selling game and cattle.
That was journalist Tuso Kumalo speaking by phone with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson. In recent months, human rights groups have accused Ethiopian government forces and their allies of carrying out ethnic cleansing and mass detentions in the embattled Tigray region. Authorities have mostly prevented rights groups and journalists from entering the region. However, VOA was given rare but limited and tightly controlled access to the region and some sites allegedly used for detentions and mass graves. Henry Wilkins was there and reports from Humara, Ethiopia.
Humara is a focal point for rights groups investigating claims of ethnic cleansing against Tigrayans. Human Rights Watch alleges that Amhara security forces have detained large groups of ethnic Tigrayans in the northern Ethiopian town without charge.
One of the last and latest phases, which was from November, December through to January this year, where we were again seeing mass arrests of Tigrayans who were remaining in certain towns, notably in the town of Humera, detentions in two facilities in particular, one prison in Humera town and one makeshift warehouse facility.
A BBC report in May quoted locals in Humera alleging Tigrayans were executed there and buried in mass graves. Ethiopian authorities blocked independent investigators and journalists from the area until May, when they gave VOA rare and unexpected access. Ashete Demelu, a local administrator in Humera, said this. He says visiting the Agricultural Institute of the Guna warehouse and other sites mentioned will show how they fabricated the story. He insisted no innocent people are imprisoned in Humera. As the saying goes, seeing is believing. Why don't you go and see some of the places, he added. VOA asked to see seven sites in Humera where alleged abuses and atrocities occurred, but local officials gave limited and controlled access to only two. The Guna warehouse, which was mentioned in the Human Rights Watch report, did not appear to have had any recent use. Wendewesen Abebe, deputy headmaster at a school next to the alleged site of a mass grave reported by the BBC, denied any such atrocity. He said to his knowledge no Tigrayans were killed and buried in a mass grave. It was not possible for VOA to determine if any bodies had been buried near the school. An official said VOA had asked too many questions and should leave the town. In other parts of the country, Tigrayans who wish not to be identified for their own security say they're being arbitrarily detained and abused. This man says the inmates at a prison he was held at were terrified as the guards frequently told them, "Get ready, you're going to be killed by tomorrow." There was not sufficient food to eat for the detainees who came from all professions, he says, adding that the prison was very hostile. He says everyone held there suffered and lost weight. Meanwhile, rights groups and independent investigators are still waiting for Ethiopian authorities to grant access to Tigray and other regions where alleged atrocities were committed by both sides in the 18-month conflict. Ethiopia's government and Amhara forces have denied claims of ethnic cleansing in West Tigray. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Humera, Ethiopia.
Hassan Sheikh Mahmud was inaugurated as the 10th president of Somalia today in a colorful ceremony attended by hundreds of people, including the leaders of Kenya, Ethiopia, and Djibouti. In his inaugural speech, Mahmud warned that in addition to the danger posed by extremist group Al-Shabaab, severe drought poses an immediate threat to the country. Mohammed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Cheers and applause punctuated the new president's speech as he promised to tackle corruption, poverty, insecurity, and the humanitarian crisis that has devastated Somalia in recent months. However, he warned the continued lack of rain could have grave consequences for the country. He says the situation in Somalia is extremely vulnerable to this drought, and there are fears that the drought will turn into famine. The president noted this drought has now happened almost every year and said there are many reasons for this, including climate change. President Mahmud outlined his agenda for the next 4 years, saying he will prioritize reconciliation and the restoration of institutions to give citizens hope. Mahmud, who previously served as president from 2012 to 2017, said that during his new term, he will ensure the rule of law is maintained, the judiciary is strengthened, people's confidence in government is restored, and poverty will be tackled. In addition, the new president thanked the international community for supporting the recently concluded electoral process. The process lasted over a year because of political disputes that at one point saw Mahmoud's predecessor attempt to extend his mandate by 24 months. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, Djiboutian President Ismail Omar Gele, and Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed also addressed the ceremony. Abiy said the peaceful handover of power of Somalia is a milestone and a major step towards the goal of achieving one-person, one-vote elections. Kenyatta said a stable Somalia is in the interest of Kenya, adding that his country is ready to open up to business opportunities between the two countries.
I personally look forward to working with you to remove all barriers to trade, to open our borders, and to establish air links between our two countries so that our people can come closer together.
The most urgent issue for the region is the drought, which has severely affected Ethiopia and Kenya as well. Hundreds of thousands have fled their homes in search of food and water, and aid agencies have warned an official declaration of famine might not be far away. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
An unidentified gunman killed a soldier and a civilian today in an attack on a gold mine in northern Burkina Faso. A security official said the pre-dawn attack at the Karma mine near Ahuiguia saw several dozen armed men, probably terrorists, raid the facility's security base. Five people were also wounded, two seriously, before the attack was repelled. A mine worker reached by the French news agency AFP said the attack lasted nearly an hour. The Karma mine was sold in March by Canada's Endeavour Mining to a Burkina consortium, Nere Mining, for $25 million last year. It produced 88,000 ounces of gold. A Russian delegation is in Mali this week to discuss economic development in the region. The visit comes as neighboring nations have condemned the Mali ruling military council's decision to extend its rule for two more years. Earlier, I spoke with Modibo Dembele, managing editor of VOA's Bambara service, about the situation in Mali. So, Modibo, talks are going on with Russian delegation in Mali. What is the objective?
Thank you so much. Remember, since the arrival of the military in power in Mali, they start shifting a little bit toward Moscow, which is not new for someone who knows that Moscow is one of the first partner of Mali who became independent in 1960. But lately, we noticed that the new authorities start shifting toward Moscow than the traditional partners, such as the Western countries like France, U.S.
Yes, yes. So is this a signal that Mali is slowly drifting towards Moscow?
Yes. I think based on the assessment that we got from Malian political analysts on the ground and the Malian authority that we got the chance to talk to them, they claim that after 9 years of the UN forced presence in Mali, so the insecurity is increasing, and therefore they decided to do a cooperation. Instead of going for the multilateralism, they opt out for the bilateralism, which is like state to state. And that's why, based on the last interview, for instance, that I got with Mali Foreign Minister, Mr. Diop, Mali has decided now to be open to any country which can really help Mali to resolve one of its issues, such as insecurity, food shortness, etc., etc.
And besides all that, we have a delay on civilian rule for at least 2 years. And it has been criticized by Mali's neighbors, ECOWAS, and even today the United States State Department has urged Malian transition government to make sustained tangible action towards holding elections. You'd think these pressures will work?
I doubt, because let's recall, for instance, I think a few months ago, Mali held a national conference during which the Malians have decided that the length for the transitions should be between 6 months to 5 years. And I think based on what the government stated in his communique, they say that they would like to act accordingly to the will of the people. That's why they pick the 24 months. But the problem may come since Mali has a landlock. So right now in Mali, more and more people, especially from the civil society, and also a part of some politicians, they are pushing the government to negotiate more with Mali, because right now, economically, some people are suffering, especially in the center of Mali and also the extreme north, where there is insecurity, and also the food shortage are pushing many of those people to ask more from the government to be more open, so then this blockage can be lifted.
Great. Managing editor of VOA's Bambara service, thank you for your input.
Thank you very much.
Belgium's King Philip continues his visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo today. Yesterday, he spoke before members of the DRC Parliament and other dignitaries.
Il a donné lieu à des exactions et des humiliations.
He says the Belgian colonial government caused abuse and humiliation. He goes on to say he wishes to reaffirm his deepest regrets for these past wounds. The king, however, did not offer a full apology for Belgium's colonial rule. King Leopold II led the plundering of the country during his reign, which ended in 1909. Millions of Congolese died under a brutal colonial administration. The DRC became independent in 1960. Some Congolese and political analysts have expressed disappointment there was no apology. Yesterday, Jean-Jacques Lumumba, the great-grandson of Patrice Lumumba, the DRC's first president, spoke to me and said his family hoped for more from the king.
The family expect an apology, but we need the justice, because today we must to render justice to the Congolese people. Lumumba, Polo and Hokito were the official politician who managed the institutional DRC. You know that Patrice Lumumba was the first prime minister of DRC, but today the justice must to be rendered to the Congolese people.
That was Jean-Jacques Lumumba, the great-grandson of Patrice Lumumba. Meanwhile, the DRC remains mired in tensions with neighboring Rwanda, despite international efforts to ease the deteriorating situation. The DRC accused Rwanda yesterday of deploying 500 Special Forces troops on its soil. The two Central African states are at odds over the recent resurgence of the M23 militia in the DRC's volatile east. The DRC has accused Rwanda of backing the rebel group. Last month, it said it had detained two Rwandan soldiers in its eastern region, holding this as proof of the country's involvement. Relations between the DRC and Rwanda have been strained since the mass arrival in the eastern DRC of Rwandan ethnic Hutus, accused of slaughtering Tutsis during the 1994 Rwanda genocide. The M23, a primarily Congolese Tutsi group, is one of more than 120 armed groups roaming the eastern DRC. Rwanda has repeatedly denied backing the M23. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. President Kais Saied has replaced 13 of Tunisia's 24 governors as the country's political crisis deepens, with plans for a general strike next week, championed by the powerful trade union. The move follows the dismissal of 57 judges accused of corruption and a cover-up of people charged with terrorism. Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Washington-based Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, discussed these developments with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi.
I think that clearly President Qais Saied has been trying to either destroy all the state institutions or bring them under his control and appoint people who are loyal to him in all these various positions in the state, including also, by the way, the High Judicial Council, the council that appoints the judges, and the Independent Election Committee that organizes the elections. So he's doing all of this in preparation for the next two steps. Number one, he wants to crack down on all his opponents, and he wants to put most of them in jail and put anyone in jail for criticizing him, and therefore silence everybody before the referendum. And then I think he wants to falsify and rig the referendum, which is scheduled for July 25, which obviously so far most people are against it, but he wants to impose the results of the referendum by rigging the elections. And to do that, he wants to control all the state institutions and put people who are loyal to him in all these positions to enforce his agenda.
The powerful Tunisian trade union said its plans for a June 16th general strike in the public sector will go ahead. The strike is to protest against what it says is the government's reluctance to engage in a dialogue. How could a general strike add to the troubled economy and raise the political stakes in the country, which is in dire need of an international rescue package from the IMF?
Well, I think that the UGTT has called for a general strike on June 16th because Qais Saied has not engaged the UGTT in a real dialogue on these economic reforms. So the economy is in deep trouble and Tunisia desperately needs an international rescue plan. But this plan and the included reforms of this plan must be discussed, they must be negotiated, they must be approved through a national dialogue process, which includes all political parties and includes the parliament and includes the major organizations such as the UGTT. But President Qais Saied has refused to engage in any kind of meaningful dialogue, and instead he has invited only people who are loyal to him, basically 20 or 30 people who have supported his coup against democracy. Qais Saied wants to impose this so-called economic reform package, but I think he will be unable to do so because these reforms are going to be very tough and very painful for the majority of Tunisians. And that is why the IMF and the international community has said that the reforms must be the outcome of a real and inclusive dialogue in order to guarantee that it has the acceptance and the support of the majority of Tunisians.
The president started a national dialogue hoping to get popular support for a referendum on a new constitution next month. How did political parties and civil society organizations respond to such a dialogue?
So far, the UGTT has refused to participate in this so-called dialogue. Also, the overwhelming majority of politicians and political parties, with really the exception of one or two very small and very tiny political parties, but everybody else has also said that they will not participate in this so-called dialogue. Civil society has been excluded and has not been invited to this dialogue. Even the deans of the law schools in Tunisia were nominated by the president to be in the drafting committee of this supposedly new constitution. But even the deans of the law schools have refused this invitation and have said that they will not participate in this dialogue or in this drafting of the new constitution. So I think that the dialogue that Qais Saied has started about a week ago is failing. And therefore, the product of this dialogue, the new constitution that will be drafted, does not enjoy and will not enjoy the support of the majority of Tunisians.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Barro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.